You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. Your pike upon your...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, May 16th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you are listening to Radio Free Northwest.
Along the valleys like the man she's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
This week on Radio Free Northwest, Comrade Jason and I have agreed that we're going to focus on more historical items. This is partly to take a break from all of the stuff we've done lately, but it's also, and more importantly, focused on replicating some of the draw that Harold provided while he was alive. Accordingly, I've decided I would like to talk about historical matters as they relate to moral authority, and in particular, I'm going to discuss one of my favorite parts of a book called The South Was Right by brothers James Ronald Kennedy and Walter Donald Kennedy. To begin, I'm actually a native Texan, and having grown up in the South, at least for a few of my childhood years, I always suspected that there was something wrong with the official narrative around the Civil War. I wasn't thinking along ideological lines, at least not consciously, though in hindsight this was probably the beginning of my racial beliefs. Many of us will come into this thing of ours having learned about some hoax that's been pulled on white people, be it Nazi Germany or the South or a whole bunch of other things throughout our history that have just been outright whitewashed in favor of the Judaic world order. And what I'm about to share with you today is no different. The narrative of blaming slavery for the Civil War is what we all grew up learning. The fact of the matter is, this can't be true. When I was a child, I suspected this was the case simply because if slavery had been the root cause, the South would not have been punished so badly for a number of different things in a number of different ways once slavery had been abolished. Everyone listening to this program will, at the very least, have a faint idea that the Civil War was not about slavery, and most of you will be outright knowledgeable and able to talk off the cuff about this subject. And that's great. But here's some new information for you that cements that fact for anyone who isn't absolutely certain of this already. It isn't well known that there were slaves in every American state prior to the formation of the nation. In fact, there were slaves in every state right up to the Civil War. There were slaves in the North after the Civil War. Yeah, you heard that right. It's true that slavery had always been an economic staple of the Northern states, even from the founding of the colonies, but it had never been especially profitable. To be more clear, the system of African slavery was never very profitable in America whatsoever, at least not for the bulk of our history leading up to the Civil War. The southern states were against it morally, the northern states not so much, and I'll prove that here in a moment. But bear in mind that the way we think about our national formation and history during, say, the Constitutional Convention and events like that is that the North decided to hold its nose and not argue the matter simply so that the southern states would agree to be part of the Union, when in fact there were arguments from the southern states against allowing slavery at all. To quote the authors of The South Was Right, the truth is that the only thing that motivated the Yankee was the principle of profit. This is clearly seen by the way in which the North granted freedom to its slave population. In their emphasis, it says, "No law was ever passed in the North that granted freedom to a person already in slavery." Contrast that with the end of the Civil War, please, and tell me that the North had moral authority. It did not. Okay, so how was slavery abolished in the North? And the answer is on a state-by-state basis, oddly enough. And because of that, it wasn't a uniform process, but generally speaking, this is how it worked. A state would pass a law, and anyone who was a slave at the time the law was passed would remain a slave their entire life. After a certain date, when children were born to slaves, those children would have to age a certain amount, and then they would be granted their freedom. Why is that important? It's called property rights. From the perspective of the Northerners, they had invested capital in, well, what do I want to call them? Not quite human resources. And if those not quite human resources were suddenly removed, all of that capital would be gone. Even in a worst case scenario, someone owning a slave and needing money could just sell the slave, get the money, and use it for something else. So this is, again, from a slaveholder's perspective, a property rights matter. That particular explanation actually holds the key to understanding what the Civil War was really about. It was the North's attempt to deprive, at least from their perspective, the southern states, and especially the very rich people, the slave owners in those states, of their own property rights, in such a way that the North would never ever do to themselves because it's odious, again, from a slaveholder's perspective. And that by itself should make the whole issue clear, simply because we keep talking about the North's actions only making sense from the perspective of someone who is a dedicated ideological supporter of slavery. In a recent panel discussion, the issue, and you'll note I brought this up very gingerly when it was brought up, but the issue of whether or not there had always been Jews in America became relevant to the America panel discussion. Of course, yes, there have always been Jews in America. It appears that Christopher Columbus' famous voyage in 1492 to the New World was secretly funded not just by Queen Isabella, but also by Spanish Jews looking for another place to live, because the situation in Europe was that their bad behavior was catching up to them. That's no shock. Remark number two, which thankfully is far more well-known within white nationalism. Jews were always at the forefront of the second historical version of African slavery, which produced the slavery we're concerned with today. In fact, they owned the ships and, if memory serves, had all sorts of other managerial roles in what turned into that massive slave trade. The book I'm talking about today actually reviews that history, though regrettably they use terms like Yankee and Southerner rather than Jew and white. I believe these authors are trying to stay politically correct and respectable while still making the point they're trying to make, which I'm not sure is possible. I don't think either of them has any white nationalist leaning, and if they do, they certainly don't reveal it in at least the portions of the book I've gone through. I point this out because I very much appreciate the author's history, though brief, of the slave trade in question, because it turns out as soon as there were people in what would become the northern colonies of America, slave ships set out. To combine that observation with the fact that yes, there were always Jews in America, and yes, the slave trade was Jewish in nature. I had intended this discussion, when I was preparing it, to be a light-hearted review of why it is that the Confederates are not the moral villains of anything ever, because it was in fact the North that even started the slave trade in the first place. But I had an epiphany, and that epiphany is this. If there were always Jews here in America, and the slave trade was Jewish in nature, that means that the Jews practically had it set as an intention to come here and start a slave trade. That's a little bit shocking when you consider their nature. Consider this in light of what we know generally about Jews and how they agitate societies into rending themselves in twain all over Jewish manufactured crises. I think this fits the pattern. Consider the Federal Reserve and how it's designed to slowly steal a nation's wealth by forcing somebody who is in dire straits to give up their property because the federal government can't pay the loan interest to the entities controlling the Federal Reserve. Also consider the Jewish agitation in Germany that took control of the country and crashed the German war effort in World War I, leading to the Weimar Republic, leading to severe abuses of Germans that led to World War II. I don't know enough about history to know whether or not this is interesting. Maybe I'm the last person to catch on to this. Let me know. In fact, let me know if you think I'm out in left field on this altogether, because again, this is an idea that popped into my head that I wanted to share with you all. Was this entire Civil War and all of the events that led up to it over a period of a couple hundred years, Jews playing the long game again? It sure seems like it, but you have to uncover an awful lot of interesting fact to get there. Anyway, I recommend the book simply because it discusses all of the pro-slavery sentiments in the North and all of the anti-slavery sentiments in the South, proving once and for all that the South was morally right.
Westbound and down, 18 wheels are rolling. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Tacoma, Washington. Just got done with a load coming from Virginia out here. And before that, I had a load coming from here over to North Carolina. So on the last weekend of April, they had snow in the Rockies. So you might want to take that into consideration for your scouting trip and moves. Yeah, the weather can get really unpredictable this time of year. Yeah, I know most of you back east and down south thinking, well, it's springtime. Well, springtime doesn't necessarily mean nice weather out here in the Rockies. Now, I had coming out of Wisconsin the last weekend of the April. There on Sunday, I ended up pulling into a rest area there in Wisconsin. It was kind of snow flaking a little bit when I pulled in there for my 10-hour break before I got ready to head through Chicago that afternoon. And when I woke up in the morning, there was a few inches of snow on the ground. They had some road closures out there in Wyoming, go figure, because of blizzard conditions and crappy roads and people wrecking and all that kind of crap. You just gotta keep an eye on the weather and hopefully have a decent weather app where you can go and watch the storm fronts and know what you're going to do and choose your route accordingly. Coming in towards the end of spring and into summer and stuff, it's tornado season in the Midwest and flyover country. So you got to go and keep that in mind too. Watch out for them twisters because, yeah, you don't want to necessarily get caught up in any of that crap. Hail can be not so much fun to go and go through, especially when they get the more severe storm and heavier, bigger hail coming down. It can bust out windshields, side windows, put big dents in cars. And if you don't believe me, well, you ought to see some of the hail damage I see going past auto dealerships out there that get caught up in that crap where they have hundreds of cars with these nice little divots, pings in them, in the hood and the roof and the trunk and all that kind of crap because they were outside, not undercover, during a really decent hailstorm. Take that into consideration. The Mississippi River is still flooding, so Iowa's getting hit with it pretty good. Pretty much from South Dakota all the way down into Missouri and stuff. They've got sections of I-29, I know, that are closed because it's flooded out. Take that into consideration also. All right. Well, I just thought I'd throw something out there this week for you guys to consider. And hope to see you out there on the road making your scouting trips and your migration soon. All right. This is the Trucker signing off from the homeland. Have a good one, comrades. Stay safe and all that.
Westbound and down, 18 wheels are rolling. We're gonna do what they say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
The trucker gave us a nice overview of the varied weather of the homeland and some things to pay attention to this time of year. I don't recall whether I have talked on RFN about the weather here in the Puget Sound around Seattle, but I will now as motivation for your settling here in the headquarters region where we need you most. I have found the weather to be amazing here. The winters this side of the Cascades are said to be generally mild, and that was certainly the case this year. I found the winter to be thoroughly enjoyable, and we only received 2 days of substantial snowfall from December to February, and it didn't really linger on the ground or cause much trouble at all. Overall, the thing that strikes me as most remarkable is the humidity. Amazingly, it is never off. Whatever the temperature, the relative humidity just feels the way that it should. It's the damnedest thing, and I love it. It's never muggy, a condition which is always oppressive and saps a man's energy and spirit. It's never too dry, which leads to unpleasant dry mouth, chapped lips, and dry skin for many of our people. The humidity just is never off. It always matches what you would expect. I had no idea before living here how this could lead to such a simple but profound enjoyment of everyday life. The sunny days in spring and summer are absolutely beautiful. I have lived for extended periods in Colorado, Oklahoma, Ohio, and Texas. And while other regions get more sun, I have never lived anywhere that has had as many perfect days in a year as I have experienced here. Over the next 5 years, I think I will experience more perfect days than I have so far in my entire life. I may be wrong about that, but that's certainly the way that it feels. The reputation for rain and overcast skies in the Seattle area is overblown. In Oklahoma, Texas, and across the American South, it is often so hot through the mid-months of the year that rain showers offer no relief. On the contrary, the wet, muggy conditions of a hot, southern, rainy day make things far worse. But as I said, there is none of that here. Even on rainy days, once again, the humidity of the air enveloping you feels just as it should. Harold talked about the weather here, that our race is not evolved for the hotter southern climes. And finally, living here, I understand instinctively what that means. You can feel the difference living up north, and you can feel that it is right for our kind. Over the mountains into the eastern reaches of the homeland, they certainly get more cold and more snowfall. But the area of the Puget Sound is its own little microclimate, a temperate zone, and it is fantastic as far as I am concerned. If you are considering your scouting trip to the homeland, you need to check out the headquarters area here in the Pugetopolis and surrounding region. We need you here for the important work to come, and if we can get you to settle here, you will love the weather and the area. Put it at the top of your list of regions to consider settling. I can't imagine you will be disappointed. Now let's move on to another review from Gretchen. She sent us her review of one of the last works of the famous modern European philosopher, Guillaume Fay, who sadly died in March of this year. This work was first published in French in 2012. The English translation was published in 2016 by Arctos, the invaluable UK publisher of the works of the modern New European Right. In this review, she happens to give the title as Anachrofuturism 2.0, when the work is actually Guillaume Fay's Archaeofuturism 2.0. Aside from that minor issue, she once again gives us an excellent review, as always. Here's Gretchen the Librarian.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to be talking about Guillaume Fay's Anachrofuturism 2.0. Now, you might think from the title that this book is something of a continuance of the original Anachrofuturism, and in a sense, I would say that it really isn't. This book takes a very long and a very deep view of society, and it takes such a long and deep view that some might even wonder if it's not going somewhat off topic. However, there are certain connections in all of these stories that tend to highlight Fay's ideology. When Fay looks at civilization, he sees it as something that is always held together by these very thin threads, and that if one part of it collapses, then the rest of it really doesn't have much hope. The first time this happens in this book is around the year 2025. So Fay is giving us about another 7 years before the unraveling that started in the First World War finally comes completely undone. And there is a near total socioeconomic collapse globally, although you will see some civilization continuing on around Flanders area in particular that he highlights, and also some civilization that is rather medieval going on in Russia. What ultimately happens is that there is a family in this book that preserves certain artifacts, one of them being a watch, one of them being a revolver, and also a piece of leather with some writing on it. And these artifacts eventually are taken to Quebec, where they're used to help rebuild civilization in that area of the world. As civilization returns in this book, so do all of its problems. That would be namely challenges like pollution, overpopulation, and also global warming, which this author definitely believes in. There's always the problem of building civilizations, and oftentimes when people are tasked with building certain civilization, oftentimes they will resort to things like slaves or servants. The problem with this is either that this underclass will eventually rebel or that they will become more advanced as a result of having to build up this society. Another thing that this author has a tendency to criticize, and particularly with regard to Islam, and much less so Christianity, but this author tends to see religion as a mechanism which can have certain helpful effects on society, but which can also, in some instances, lead to either fanaticism or overconfidence. The author does have some criticism of that, and there will be some needling of that here and there. And ultimately, when this author looks at the world, he sees three very elemental forces, one of them being the driving force of catastrophe, which is always near at hand for this author. The other driving force would be evolution. And hand in hand with evolution, really the notion of competitiveness of both subgroups and also species. Another thing this author seems to note is that there's really no escaping of either an individual's nature or societal nature. And this author, because he does take such a very long and very deep view, he does have a little story towards the end of the book, and this is after the killer asteroid has struck the Earth. Humans have been completely wiped out, both on the Earth and also on Mars. And of course, normally we think of a space program as something of an insurance policy in case there ever was a catastrophic extinction event on Earth. But because this author sees civilization as being bound together by these threads that are very fragile, for him, such a catastrophe would also have an effect on Mars in some way or another, even if in some sort of indirect way. He just realizes that society is so interwoven, especially when it's highly technologically advanced, that he takes a dim view of pockets of societal survival. The story that takes place with this other species, and I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to spoil it for you. There's a rather dark humor in what he says, both about individual natures, whatever natures they may be, and also the nature of society. So this author, I think, really wants us to take from these series of stories the notion that the most important thing to do is to watch out for certain threats and to not become overconfident due to some sort of religious belief or due to any kind of propagandistic belief, which is helpful in certain situations, but unhelpful in others. And I have to say that I found this book to be the kind of literature that provokes the imagination and could actually lead to a certain amount of daydreaming. I would suggest reading this book when you're on vacation, for example, because this could lead to a certain amount of distraction, which isn't always desirable in every situation. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion. Have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
Last month was a very interesting month. A lot of very notable things happened in April 2019 that indicate where we have come as a society, and there are two that I want to address in particular. The first is that Jared Taylor of American Renaissance was banned from travel in Europe until 2021, as Mr. Taylor was awaiting a connecting flight in Switzerland to travel to Finland to attend the Skanza Forum. Swiss police informed him that Polish authorities had barred him from traveling through the Schengen zone, which is the EU's 26-country region that allows for visa-free travel. It seems odd that this would come from Poland, which, as we know, has been smart enough to exclude the Muslim migrant invaders that since 2015 have descended on Europe in the greatest numbers in history. Poland truly seems to want to preserve its people, heritage, and culture, and understands this racial and cultural exclusion is absolutely necessary. But apparently there are still plenty of Poles in the government who don't fully get it, and are willing to ban a prominent international white advocate like Mr. Taylor. A source I read on it wrote, "It's unclear why Polish authorities issued a blanket ban against Taylor." Taylor attributed the ban to a 2018 trip to the country where he gave multiple television interviews. During that trip, Taylor said that Polish police said he was, quote, "spreading a totalitarian ideology," end quote. Regardless of the reasons for this action by the Polish government, there is a lesson here. Jared Taylor is a true gentleman by all accounts, and carries himself with dignity and fights for our people in the same way. It would be impossible to imagine any better example of a respectful and respectable white advocate anywhere. But this seems to have gained him absolutely nothing in this instance. It is an outrage that a white advocate like Mr. Taylor could be banned from travel to the historical ancestral lands of the very people he is trying to save, his own. And yet this is what has happened. Several internationally prominent white men and women working to resist the non-white invasion of Europe and preserve Europe for future generations have been banned in various European nations over the past several years. One of the things we are coming to learn about this is that respectfulness and respectability will obviously not save any white advocate from completely arbitrary and capricious abuse by our opposition. I don't profess to know whether Jared Taylor has ever particularly pulled his punches with his white advocacy, whether he has avoided saying what he thought needed to be said, expressly for the purpose of cultivating an air of respectability. But if he has, he has learned it isn't going to get him anything in the world at which we have arrived today. To my mind, it is essentially a waste of time trying to cultivate respectability within the social landscape that has been defined by our enemies. It is a losing proposition from the start. You simply will not escape abuse and dirty underhanded tactics, whatever you do. So let's not worry about it. Let's not worry about respectability. When you worry about someone else's opinions of you, you give them power over you. And we are seeking to take power, not to give it away. In all circumstances, we should say what we have to say and do what we need to do and let the chips fall where they may. The second thing that arose in April that I want to address is this fascinating furor over the supposed anti-Semitism on the left that was kicked up by the representative of Minnesota's 5th District, Ilhan Omar, and her comments about Jews and Israel. Now, if you don't know about her, she is one of the first Muslim women in Congress and was elected in the 2018 midterms, taking the seat of Keith Ellison, the first Muslim ever elected to the Congress in either house. The 5th District in Minnesota covers all of Minneapolis and some of the surrounding suburbs, and is the number one place in America that the State Department Refugee Processing Center has been dumping Somali Muslim invaders, so-called refugees, of course, since the Somali Civil War of the early 1990s. For 25 years, our State Department has built up this enclave of foreign Muslim radicalism, which is now poised to perpetually elect Muslim non-whites to exercise political power over real white Americans in Minneapolis, who have lost their political voice in their own country to alien invaders. The FBI, in fact, confirms that the 5th District has the highest concentration of Islamic terrorist recruitment and activity in America. One can only wonder if this was actually the goal of a long-term plan, in part to see what corruption and havoc could be introduced socially and politically into a highly homogeneous white region. And I think it's impossible to discount such a motive for the traitors in the American State Department of the present day. Anyway, back in April, Representative Omar, having been able to see how the cesspool on the Potomac actually functions for nearly a year and a half, made remarks about how she thought it inappropriate that she should feel pressured to in effect swear an oath to a foreign power before she is allowed to exercise her powers in furtherance of her duties as a representative in the Congress. Her remarks were directed towards the Israel lobby in America, of course, and she made additional remarks that called into question the dual loyalties of other legislators and citizens who sound and behave as if they are beholden to Israel over America. Well, the Jews and their suck-up white lackeys absolutely lost their minds. Her critical tweets about Israel from the past were dredged up, and the accusations of anti-Semitism flew heavy and thick as the Jewish outrage machine kicked into high gear. For the past month and a half, certain heavily Jewish organs in the new media have been on a kick in pushing the growing narrative that has been going on for a couple years now about heavy anti-Semitism from the left. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party in the UK has been dealing with this accusation in a very real way for over a year, and antecedents of this argument have been growing for far longer than that. But as we know, 70 to 80% of Jews vote with the left in every election. Leftist communist Jews basically captured the Democratic Party in America during the 1960s, and their philosophies and many of their personalities control the left here in America as well as in the UK and most other white Western nations. So what is going on here? What is with this classic propaganda smear of anti-Semitism now being applied to the left rather than to the right? Well, it has to do with a long-standing movement that comes from the left, often referred to by the acronym BDS, which stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It is a liberal and leftist movement to get Western governments and businesses to apply economic pressure on Israeli businesses and the Israeli state because of the government's support for replacement-level Jewish settlement in the West Bank, violence against Palestinian protesters in the Gaza Strip, and general mistreatment of Palestinians as second-class citizens within Israel. It apparently has real rhetorical and economic teeth, at least to a limited degree. But the most important attribute about it is that it has been around for a long time, is truly international in scope, being both here and in most countries in Europe, and shows no real signs of weakening. Lefties are apparently quite committed to it, and it seems the Jews are getting tired of it. There have always been a subset of Jews who think it is a mistake to conflate criticism of Israel with Jew hatred or anti-Semitism overall, and just as large a subset who think it is actually the best way for them to go. The problem is that their knee-jerk reactions to attacking criticism of Israel as necessarily anti-Semitic is not really working anymore because of the dynamics of non-white victimhood that Jews themselves have done so much to set up in society. The blacks and browns are turning against the Jews and their influence, accusing Jews themselves of being an integral part of the white power structure that keeps a brother down. And they are not wrong in this, of course. Jews are the single wealthiest and most influential group in America. We certainly know that good, racially loyal whites do not run things. America is run by white-hating Jews and their anti-racist, white race traitor lackeys. What the Jews are being faced with from the left is not actually anti-Jewish sentiment like they want to pretend for their own purposes. It's merely leftists who have sucked up the Jewish propaganda of anti-racism, fake equality, tolerance, and multiracialism and multiculturalism, and are trying to hold Jews themselves to those standards in Israel. But the Jews are, of course, consciously hypocritical about this, because that stuff was never meant for Jews to live by. We know it has always just been propaganda designed for soft-hearted, soft-headed, gullible whites to weaken us. Ben Shapiro, the fast-talking Jew huckster of the Daily Caller, has a good analysis of what is going on. It comes back to the philosophy of intersectionalism that grew out of the cesspool of victimology that is third-wave feminism. The basis of intersectionality is really just your good old-fashioned factionalism, the stacking of recognized victim groups according to how their multiple victim identities intersect in their daily lives under the heel of white male oppression. The victim categories are ranked, and the more of them that you fall into, the more worthy of defense you are from the oppressive white patriarchy, and the higher your overall victimhood status. A woman of color ranks higher than a white woman, and a lesbian woman of color ranks higher still. In this rank ordering of victimology, according to Shapiro, Jews rank basically at the bottom. He does not say so, but it is obvious that Jews suffer from their own efforts at camouflaging themselves as just whites with a non-traditionally white religion. It is clear that blacks, browns, and yellows have bought into this incorrect premise, and the vast majority of them do think of Jews as white. There is some awareness that they are not truly the demonized white male enemy of legend, but this understanding is quite shallow and is offset by the fact that Jews as a group are rich and own and run so many things. They are seen by the real victim communities of color as part of the existing power structure, and therefore are not entitled to protections that are due to religious minority women of color like Representative Ilhan Omar. Consequently, these communities of color have risen to her defense with a vengeance. The non-whites that Jews have aimed at us so effectively as their sociological attack dogs are, in a sense, now turning on their masters. This has been immense fun to watch if you have been paying attention. Very quickly after the Jews raised their cry of anti-Semitism against Representative Omar, the Darkey coalition began making excuses for her and attacking the Jews in return, accusing them of trying to silence her freedom of speech through intimidation. Now, where have we heard of the Jews trying that kind of thing before? The most brilliant example of these blacks and browns turning on the Jews even occurred right here in the front's own backyard, in Seattle. There was a panel discussion seminar planned for May 2nd, and as far as I know actually held, that was entitled Intersectional Dialogue on Weaponizing Charges of Anti-Semitism. The premise being that Jews were cynically deploying their specious anti-Semitism rhetoric to silence, quote, powerful black and Muslim leaders, end quote. This weaponization of rhetoric is obviously Jewish standard operating procedure, but it is remarkable that they are being called out for it from within their own anti-white racial coalition. Amazingly, Jews are now having to fight to maintain control of the anti-white resistance and to keep themselves at the top of the food chain in the victimhood ghetto. We have always known that the only thing keeping the multiracial anti-white opposition together is the unifying mantra of get whitey. But as our social degeneration advances and blacks and browns actually begin to acquire real influence and power, these squabbling non-whites were destined to turn on one another to fight over the pie. We knew it would happen, but it's still amazing to see it finally begin in earnest. It's bittersweet because it means we've reached another milestone on the road to dissolution. But we're on this journey no matter what we do, so we might as well enjoy whatever aspects of it that we can. Anti-Semitism is, of course, the special Jewish exclusive version of their other propaganda word, racism, that Jews weaponized against all of white civilization during the 20th century. I have wanted to return to the theme of how we must lean into the racism propaganda deployed against us in order to overcome it. This is something that I laid out on RFN 7 years ago with an exposé of the origins of this propaganda word that we have allowed to get so out of control. I'll play it again here, and then I'll have some concluding remarks. Here is what I sent Harold back in 2012, which is just as relevant now as it was then.
Okay, now we got a piece from Jason in Oklahoma. Some of you may remember him from a couple of months ago.
I've been working on what looks to become a 3-part submission to Radio Free Northwest, and in this first of the three, I want to begin by discussing what I see as the biggest gap in our rhetoric in our battle for racial survival, and that is the continuing failure of white patriots to spread the knowledge of the origin of the word racism and the circumstances and purpose behind its creation. As some of us have observed, the accusation of racism and the fostering of white people's fear of it have been the central means used over the last 60 years to delegitimize white history, culture, and civilization, and thereby mentally and emotionally subjugate our people in almost every single one of our nations. Through the unceasing use of racism propaganda in our media, universities, workplaces, and legal systems, white people have been conditioned to fear being called or thought of as racist more than any other social stigma. It's undeniable that our enemies have been extremely effective in using the conceptual beating sticks of racism and anti-Semitism to collectively turn the greatest conquering race in the history of the world into a pack of frightened, cowering dogs. We whites are so beaten down mentally and emotionally by never-ending accusations of racism that when each new one arises, most of us roll over on our sides and whimper pathetically to avoid the application of the stick again, all while non-whites across our civilization flood our lands to systematically rob us of everything we have. It is long past time that we nullified this bullshit once and for all. Now, the only real way to do this is the same way in which we will achieve ultimate victory, and that is to stop running. Whites must stop running from being called racist and instead learn how to turn and counterattack. And we must mentally arm one another with the correct understanding of this word to replace the anti-white associations which the Jews have assigned it. Although the racism stick still works, white tolerance of it is wearing very thin. If we can be successful in delivering a new understanding of the word to enough of our fellow whites, I predict we will be stunned at how quickly our people's general perceptions and attitudes will shift and begin to cascade in our favor. The first step is to dramatically increase the number of our people who have the knowledge of racism's origin and the purpose of the word's creation. Not one in a thousand white people knows this, when every single white person needs to, because whites are the direct targets of this word. The word did not just arise through random chance and the unguided permutations of an evolving language. It was created at a specific time, in a specific place, by identifiably anti-white agents for a malicious purpose. We have known the details of the beginning of racism propaganda for quite a while now, but we have done next to nothing with it. We do not seem to have spread the knowledge very widely at all, and I think that is because white racial advocates have spectacularly failed to understand the central importance and incredible usefulness of this revelation. The knowledge was delivered to us in 1999 by Sam Francis, a brilliant former writer for the Washington Times, who was a frequent contributor to American Renaissance and a speaker at their conferences when he was alive. Sam Francis sought to find the first public use of the word racism in the English language. It had to have a recent origin, since the American Founding Fathers knew of no such word. Neither was it known in Europe or anywhere else in our civilization until the 20th century. Francis wrote about his findings in his article, The Origins of Racism, The Curious Beginnings of a Useless Word, which was originally published in the May 99 issue of American Renaissance. This is the best thing I ever learned from Jared Taylor's publication, and finding Francis's article online is simple. Just enter the words Francis, racism, and useless into any web browser, and it will be right at the top of your results. This article is also contained in Sam Francis's book, Essential Writings on Race, which was published after his death by his friend Mr. Taylor in 2007. Francis tracks the first widespread public use of the word to 1930s Germany and a man by the name of Magnus Hirschfeld, and his book of the same title, Racism, which was written in 1933 and 34. Magnus Hirschfeld was a homosexual, a communist, and a Jew, or what can be thought of as a triple outsider in German society of that time, and he readily displays the mentality of the outsider in his book. He was an early sexologist, like the American homosexual pervert sex researcher Alfred Kinsey, and just like Kinsey, had the aim of making abnormal sexual appetites of all kinds, but especially homosexuality, acceptable to the social mainstream in Western nations. It is clear that Hirschfeld's work was an attempt to force open for his quote-unquote kind the society that held him as an outcast due to his race, his politics, and his perversions. Hirschfeld died in 1935, and his work seems not to have been published in Germany, although Francis tells us that it was published in 1938 in Great Britain after it was translated into English by British citizens Eden and Cedar Paul, who were husband and wife and worked as a team in translating numerous books written in many languages. They can be found on Wikipedia, and you should look them up. Eden, like the garden, Cedar, like the tree, and Paul, as in Bunyan. Wikipedia reveals that they were both lifetime socialists and members of several leftist parties. The entry for Eden Paul says he officially joined the Communist Party of Great Britain. The entry for his wife Cedar Paul reveals that the two of them, in addition to translating Hirschfeld's book, Racism, also edited it, presumably to put it in a form appropriate for publication. This raises the question of who it was that labored to get Hirschfeld's unfinished and unpublished work into their hands for dissemination. And it suggests this husband and wife team clearly served a vital role in what used to be called, with perfect descriptive accuracy, the International Communist Conspiracy, and that they used their translation skills to disseminate communist thought throughout the world. Eden and Cedar Paul translated many political tracts by such communist heavy hitters as Leon Trotsky, Stalin, Bukharin, Lenin, and Rosa Luxemburg, as well as an entire laundry list of lesser-known socialist and communist writers. It is absolutely clear that their life's work was not just translation for the spread of knowledge, but more specifically, translation to further the spread of communism. This role of theirs would have been well known among the higher echelons of control within the international apparatus of communist cells and networks. And it is really no surprise that Hirschfeld's pivotal work made its way to these two. But after uncovering these historical actors, curiously, Francis doesn't draw the obvious conclusions, and he avoids pointing the fingers in the natural directions. Some of his language toward the end of his article is very subtle, and I think a careful reading shows us that he actually does know what it all really means. But Sam Francis always was the type of white activist, like his friend Taylor, who self-consciously bends over backward to avoid naming the Jew. Ultimately, he ducks the real conclusions to be drawn from the history of racism's creation and proceeds to the matter of its use in language and culture. He writes, "No one seems ever to have used the word to describe his own ideas or ideas with which he agrees. Its only application has been by the enemies of the ideas it purports to describe, and hence it has no objective meaning apart from its polemical usage. If no one calls his own ideas racism, and its only application is to a body of ideas considered to be untrue and evil, then it has no use other than as a kind of fancy curse word, the purpose of which is simply to demonize anyone who expresses the ideas it is supposed to describe." So we see that Francis knows full well that the word's only significance is not linguistic. Rather, it is purely political. This point is really quite unarguable. Francis has another point about the word's uselessness, however, and adds that racism, quote, has been so defined and loaded with meanings the left wants it to have that it cannot now be used by the supporters of white racial consciousness for any constructive purpose. Anyone who uses the term to describe himself or his own views has already allowed himself to be maneuvered onto his opponent's ground and has already lost the debate. He may try to define the word differently, but he will need to spend most of his time explaining that he does not mean by it what everyone else means. As to this second point, I used to agree with this assessment that the word is essentially useless to white advocates for our own arguments, but I have recently done a complete 180 on this, and there will be more on that in the second installment. But I will say now that Francis's only real failing in this article is the very one that leads him directly to this erroneous conclusion, and that is his decision to talk in a milquetoast and vague way about, quote, the left, and thereby avoid a more pointed and accurate accusation against the mainly Jewish communist revolutionary agents behind the scenes. However, despite Francis's unwillingness to go the distance in his analysis, he must be given full credit for this extremely important reveal. He has shown us the precise way in which this mental pathogen was introduced into the white host, and how it gained its currency in our language across the broader spectrum of white civilization. If Sam Francis showed how the word was widely introduced, sources elsewhere suggest that it was one of the biggest names in Bolshevism, the Jew Leon Trotsky, who actually originated the word. A net search reveals that Trotsky used the word racist in some of his writings at least as far back as 1930. And indeed, it is known that Trotsky was well aware of the revolutionary potential inherent in racial conflict. Developing concepts for organizing America's blacks for revolution was a major focus of Trotsky's ideological work in the 1920s, so it seems a good bet that this blood-soaked murderer, along with one or more of his close compatriots, was the true originator of the word racism. So the international communist Jew, Leon Trotsky, creates the concept and the word, and the international communist Jew, Magnus Hirschfeld, fleshes out the concept into a book titled with, and obviously designed to unveil the magic word, and the international communist agents, Eden and Cedar Paul, spread the word, translating it into English to achieve the widest possible penetration into the white nations of the West for the shiny new propaganda. It may sound like the tagline to some bad Cold War Hollywood B-movie script, but the truth of the matter is that racism is a propaganda creation of the well-documented and very real international communist conspiracy of the mid-20th century. Of course, the thing that you and I understand is that communism is, in almost all essentials, a specifically Jewish creation. Communism has always been lousy with Jews, and Jews everywhere are lousy with communism. After World War II, Jews began to exercise what amounted to near monopoly control over publishing and communications media in white nations. So, with our ancient enemy's fabrication of the Holocaust hoax placed into the context of this powerful new Jewish propaganda concept of racism, the deadly mental sickness of white guilt, which has always been with us at low levels, was efficiently nurtured into full bloom and spread throughout our civilization. In retrospect, the strategy becomes crystal clear. It was always to find an ideological weapon that could be used to delegitimize nearly everything about whites and the West, to destroy our collective strength by destroying our sense of moral superiority that flowed directly from our clear civilizational superiority. The need was to shift the moral high ground, and therefore the social advantage, to the outsider, the alien, the quote-unquote victims of white racism. And that meant, above all else, the result would be a shifting of the social and political advantage to communist Jews, who have long considered themselves to be the conscience of the world in their role as history's biggest, quote, victims and most persecuted minority, don't you know?
Oy vey, we're so persecuted for just no reason.
After this analysis, each of us should be able to see that the following is an entirely proper characterization of the word. That racism is nothing more than Jewish communist propaganda designed to get whites to give up control of our own nations without a fight. Racism was intended as the means to vilify and abuse whites to such an extent that it would make us submit to alien domination, and it has worked just as our enemy intended. In my opinion, as a conceptual tool for societal and national subversion, the creation of racism surpasses anything the world has ever seen before. This is how it went down. This is how they did it. And we've let them get away with it, scot-free. So far, that is. Next time I'm going to talk about how to actually use this knowledge effectively, because God knows we haven't done so yet. I'll also present strategies to create conceptual resistance to this word that we can use to help our friends and families escape the mental and emotional straitjacket that racism propaganda has put on so many white minds. And I'll explain how the propaganda of racism does have an intuitive basis, one which explains its widespread acceptance in our culture, but that it is a basis which actually allows us to co-opt the word and use it for our own purposes, if only we will stop running from it. Now, I never did produce those other two segments. Soon after this, I moved into video production for the front and did not send in another audio submission. I was okay with that because I had at least delivered what I thought and still think is a key component of our resistance, making the knowledge of the creation and purpose of the word racism known so widely in society that it loses all power to guilt trip our people into acting against our racial interests, and can never again be used as a rhetorical prod for our racial and civilizational suicide. I will return to this again in the future, but one of the other things we should notice is that the now frequent use of the name of our philosophy of white nationalism in the political language of government officials and the explosion of the alt-right onto the stage of the 2016 presidential election show clearly that our numbers are growing because the power of racism propaganda is fading. The use of the Jews' anti-Semitism propaganda is now also being openly challenged. These are fantastic developments, and I have spent so much of this show highlighting this in order to give us hope and to help steel our resolve. There is no question that our enemies won the culture war, but our enemy's position is now weakening at the exact moment of his triumph. By winning, he introduced the very weaknesses into society that we will now be able to exploit to work our way free of the mental and emotional straitjacket that has held white society prisoner for so long. The fact that we see stories now of blacks lamenting the changes in their neighborhoods occasioned by gentrification, a phenomenon whereby whites move into a rundown non-white area and take it over, raising the quality and desirability of the area and pricing non-whites out, proves that whites can take back lost territory. In the midst of all the things that are wrong, there are many things that are going right. Morale is an essential part of resistance, and there are some very good things to be hopeful about. I was pleased to share some of them with you this time. So that's it for this week. Stay strong, comrades. Maintain your intent and keep your spirits up. As Harold said in different ways many times, the final battle will go to our side. When the full story of white humanity is finally written, it will end in this way. All of these things came to pass, and then the white man won.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, hail victory.